Good morning, welcome to Kol Yom Rishon, our second of the year. Rabbi Shmidman apologizes, he had a rabbinic emergency, he had to run out, as you saw even from davening, so he might be back for part of it, but if not, he apologizes. He especially wanted to hear his good friend Rabbi Feldman. Rabbi Feldman is the author of many books. I just heard him give a great lecture on Judaism and humor, and one of the great things about Rabbi Feldman is his ability to integrate humor into his encyclopedic knowledge of Torah. I think he is probably as much of a Bucky in The Simpsons as he is in all the different Shutim and the Achronim and the Rishonim that we know, so I think we're in for a treat. His topic is asking for Mechila on before Yom Kippur. And without further ado, Rabbi Feldman.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Saif. The announced topic is one that is very crucial for this time of year. Perhaps, arguably, one of the most crucial mitzvahs that we have, because the Talmud tells us that if we fail to do this mitzvah, we're going to be missing a very fundamental part of what we are aiming for. The whole idea of achieving a kapara, achieving an atonement throughout this Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur period, the Talmud tells us that to a certain degree, and perhaps to a very big degree, all of our success is contingent upon our fulfilling this one mitzvah. And it's not shofar and it's not fasting, but it's a very specific obligation, and that is the asking of mechila, the asking of forgiveness from those whom we have offended. The Mishnah tells us in the Maseches Yuma that even though Yom Kippur brings about an atonement, that's only true if we have achieved forgiveness, if we have requested forgiveness from those whom we have offended. If we haven't, then, says the Mishnah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to forgive until we do that. That itself is somewhat of a difficult statement to figure out exactly what that means. What does it mean that God's not going to forgive us unless others forgive us? Very powerful idea. Really places the victim's rights front and center. It tells us that your responsibility is not just between you and God, even in the sense of atonement, even in the sense of your personal redemption, but your responsibility is to whoever you've been dealing with. And this idea that God's not going to forgive, we find many different interpretations. There are those who understand that it means that sometimes you're going to have a mitzvah, you're going to have some type of an obligation or some type of an offense which has a interpersonal aspect and a ben adam lamakom aspect. There's something that both offends God and offends people in what you did. And God is saying, in that case, I'm not going to let go of my part until human beings let go of their part. And anytime we're both co-victims in this act, I'm not going to forgive until the human victim forgives. Others take this a little bit further. There's a commentary in the back of the Shulchan Aruch called the Pri Chadash, who quotes an opinion that this is a reference really to all transgressions between man and man, because really any interpersonal avera, really, by definition, contains both aspects. Because you offended the person, and this is a violation of God's Torah. Therefore, by its very nature, any time that you violate any transgression between man and man, you're also at the same time offending God, so to speak. So God's saying, I'm not giving up my part until the human victim gives up his part. But there's an even more sweeping understanding that you find in some of the sources, among them the Vilna Gaon and his Siddur. The Vilna Gaon maintains an unbelievable thing. Says the Yom Kippur is not going to work at all. It's not going to be effective for anything, even the offenses between man and God, unless you first settle all the issues that you have with people you're offending. And that's a very, very surprising statement. That's a very powerful statement. We have to try to figure out a little bit what exactly is going on there. Why would that be true? What exactly is the nature of this obligation of asking for mechila? So on the surface, one could assume that this is about a waiver of claims. You know that you commit a crime against someone, if it's a minor enough crime, if the victim decides not to press charges, so the police will let you go. So perhaps that's what we're talking about here. Maybe this is an issue where the victim has the ability to press charges or not press charges. And God's saying, listen, if he presses charges, you're in trouble. But if he drops the claim, if he's willing to forget about it, then I'll drop the prosecution as well. So if that were the case, might be the case, but if that were so, then we could assume that let's say you have a situation where the offender doesn't ask for forgiveness, but the victim forgives anyway. Let's say we had some way of knowing that the victim publicly announces he forgives this guy, or somehow it's conveyed in some sense that there's a forgiveness anyway. If that were the case, we shouldn't require the offender to actually ask. If it was just about dropping charges, if the guy announces, I'm dropping all the charges, that should be enough. So is that really the case? Is it true that if you know that the victim is willing to forgive, then you don't have to ask for mechila, you don't have to ask for forgiveness? So many of the poskim who talked about this thought that wasn't the case. There were those who thought maybe on some level it's true, and there are many who thought it's not really true at all. They point to a story the Gemara has in Maseches Yuma, without getting into the details, somewhat of an intense story. But the Talmud talks about a Rav who was offended by a certain butcher, and Yom Kippur was approaching. So Rav decided it's about time for this butcher to ask him for forgiveness. So the Talmud tells us that Rav tried to make himself available so the butcher would have an easy time of asking him for forgiveness. There was one of the great Musar writers, who was also one of the great halachic authorities, Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer, known as Rabbi Tzla Petterberger, was a student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So he wrote in one of his svarim that this action, making himself available, this is an act of the halachta bedrachav. We read about in yesterday's parsha, we should imitate God. So God does this as well, that during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. So the Talmud tells us, Dirshu as Hashem Bihimatzo, the Pasuk says, that we should seek out God when He is nearby, when He's easily available. And the Talmud says, Elu Aseres Hayamim Shebein Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. These are the 10 days of tshuva. During that time, God makes himself available, so to speak, so we can have an easier time asking for forgiveness. So Rav did the same thing. He made himself available so that he should be able to grant forgiveness. And things didn't work out that well. You could look in the Talmud to find the whole discussion. But the commentaries note that clearly here Rav's ready to forgive, and yet he's waiting for the person to ask. Apparently there's a necessity. It's not just enough to issue a forgiveness, but there is still a requirement that the offender actually request it. And therefore, there's also a discussion that some of the poskim have. So there is a practice that developed over the past couple hundred years. There was a tefillah that was written by the author of the Chayei Adam. It's known as the Tefillah Zaka. It's printed in the Machzorim. So many people have a practice, if they come to shul early enough, it's hard sometimes to get enough time. If you come to shul a good few minutes before Yom Kippur starts, so then hopefully you have time to recite the Tefillah Zaka. And one of the things that's contained in that tefillah is you forgive anybody who has done anything wrong to you. If they owe you money, you still want to take the money, you're not going to forgive the money, but anything else, any other type of offense, you're going to forgive that. So maybe you should choose your victims carefully. Make sure only to offend people who you know say the Tefillah Zaka. That'll save you a lot of time. You won't have to ask them for forgiveness, because you'll know they go to shul and they recite this tefillah. So is that a good strategy? Might be a better strategy than the alternative, but the poskim assume that that's not going to be enough. That even if you know this guy makes a public announcement, he forgives everybody, doesn't have any complaints against anybody, you still have a requirement to ask for forgiveness. The Talmud also talks about Marzutra, and some say this every night, that Marzutra, when he would go to sleep at night, he would say, Sharileh, I forgive anyone who ever offended me. So he's really making himself an open target for people. So then he should really be the ideal victim. Pick on him all the time, because he'll never have to ask for mechila, not just Erev Yom Kippur, but every day he's going to be forgiving everybody. So the poskim don't assume that's the case. They assume that even if your victim is Marzutra, or even if your victim was the Chayei Adam, or anybody who recited his tefillah, any of those people, you still have an obligation to ask them for forgiveness, even if it's clear that they are ready to drop the charges. So that's a surprising idea, that if it's just about getting a release of claims, so then why should I have to ask? If the guy made it clear he's going to drop the charges, I shouldn't seem to have an obligation to have to ask. So we'll discuss that more in a moment, just to highlight another interesting idea that the Poskim thought was noteworthy, is the whole focus. So here the Mishnah is introducing this concept of asking forgiveness in connection with Yom Kippur. It actually comes up elsewhere. We'll talk about that a little bit as well. But the idea that it's connected to Yom Kippur specifically, so many thought that that's not really necessary. That presumably if I hurt somebody's feelings on Purim, I should ask him for forgiveness on Purim. If I do something offensive on Shavuos, I should ask his forgiveness to the day after Shavuos. What exactly is the assumption that there's some kind of connection to Yom Kippur here? So some understand that, of course, if I hurt somebody's feelings, so I have an obligation to ask forgiveness right away. It's just that Yom Kippur is the upper deadline. That's the upper limit. There's an interesting suggestion that one of the contemporary authors wrote, where he makes an interesting distinction. We'll have to try to come back to this a little bit. He says that if I offend someone and he's upset, so then I should try to deal with it right away. If he's not so upset, then I have until Yom Kippur. So what exactly does that mean? What exactly is going on there in terms of this whole nature of asking for forgiveness and the connection to Yom Kippur? What exactly is going on? It seems like there's something here that's a little bit more than asking for a release from claims. And it seems like there is some type of desire that we should go through a certain process, that we shouldn't just get the goal, we shouldn't just receive the forgiveness, but that we have to go through some process first, and that's apparently as important. There's a joke they tell about yeshiva guys. People are drinking coffee. So they say the yeshiva guys, they know that when they drink coffee, so if they want to make the coffee sweeter, so they stir the sugar into the coffee. But they're not really sure what is it that makes the coffee sweeter. Is it that the sugar makes the coffee sweeter? Or maybe it's really the stirring that makes the coffee sweeter. And the sugar's there just so you know that when the sugar dissolves, you've stirred enough. That's a question they may ask in the yeshivas. So you have a similar question. It's a similar question that's asked here, and it's not even a joke. A similar question discussed with Binyamin Yehoshua Zilber, was one of the great Musar writers, was also a great posek. So he asks a very similar question here. What exactly is going on? When the Mishnah says you have to ask for forgiveness, is it really that you need to obtain forgiveness? Or maybe it's that you need to ask. And how do we know if you asked properly? Because if the person gives you forgiveness, so then you probably asked properly. Which is a fascinating idea. Now, what's that based on? So that we'll have to figure out. And could be there are a number of possibilities. But there are some who suggest that it's based on the fact that it's somewhat of a submissive experience to have to do this, to have to come hat in hand and to ask forgiveness from somebody you've offended. It's not an easy thing to do. It involves a certain amount of overcoming of one's tendencies and one's personality and one's instincts. And that itself is a very major step of growth. That itself is something which is a key part of the repentance process. So if somebody's able to do that, somebody's able to come to somebody who he thought was worth offending yesterday and now say, I was wrong, so then that's something that's very significant. The Talmud has a statement, some point out, the Talmud says that somebody who does an avera, somebody who commits some type of a transgression, umishpayesh, and he's embarrassed about it, so the Talmud says, mochlin lo, he gets forgiven, so far not so surprising, but goes on to say, mochlin lo, al kol avonosav, he's forgiven for everything. That's a great deal. If I'm forgiven for this one transgression, I could understand that. But I'm forgiven for everything just because I'm embarrassed about this one transgression. So some of the commentaries suggest, yeah, that's what's going on. That essentially this process of feeling embarrassment for having sinned and having to come and to be submissive about it, that is part of the repentance process that's effective not just for this one transgression you're focusing on, but it's effective on a larger scale. So that's an interesting idea, and we'll follow up on that for a few minutes. But it reflects this notion, perhaps, that maybe we're interested not just in receiving what we're asking for, but the asking is as or maybe even more important. Maybe it's really the stirring that makes the coffee sweeter, and the sugar is just there to tell us when we've stirred enough. So that could explain, for example, there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, that sometimes it's going to happen, unfortunately, a person's going to ask for forgiveness, and the victim's not going to want to forgive. So he'll come back again the next day and he'll ask again. And it's again the person's not going to forgive. So the Shulchan Aruch says if he asks three times and the person doesn't forgive after three times, so then he's done what he has to do. Then he's off the hook. That's not the way you learn in elementary school. We'll discuss this in a couple of contexts. Elementary school, they think, say, you mochum me, okay, I'm done. It doesn't work that way. You have to do it three separate occasions, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But you made three sincere attempts to ask for forgiveness, and the individual said no each time, okay, you can move on. Which is a very strange idea, because if it's about obtaining something, so we don't find this in any other area of life. Right? You have a teenager who wants to borrow a car from his father, says, Dad, can I borrow the car? No. Dad, can I borrow the car? No. Dad, can I borrow the car? No. Okay, now I get the car. Because I asked you three times, you said no, so automatically it's mine. So we don't find this in any other area of life. If you have to ask permission, and you ask three times, it doesn't change anything. And especially if we use a more direct comparison, if it's about dropping claims, if somebody's suing you. So there's no law that if you ask the guy to drop the case three times and he doesn't drop it, so all of a sudden he's the guilty party. It doesn't work that way. So what exactly is going on here that there is this exemption after three times? So it seems to be, and this is how the Pri Chodesh and others explain, that essentially, really, it's the process that what we're really interested in. We're really interested in the individual should be asking for forgiveness. So ideally, if we're dealing with reasonable people, so if he did a good job, if he asked effectively, so then at least by the third time, if not earlier, he should succeed in getting forgiven. But if he really did it properly, and he tried three times, and he's not getting the response he's looking for, okay, so that's not his problem anymore. Then it's apparently past the standard for what's required of a reasonable request. That's an interesting idea, which may be relevant to this whole process here. And maybe, again, so far we've seen maybe the idea is that you're supposed to go through some type of a submissive experience that will hopefully have an effect on your growth process here, which could be relevant to another question. I remember a few years ago seeing the front page of one of the Jewish weeklies, so I wanted to convey kind of a modern sense, I guess, of the front page, had an article, Can You Ask Mechila Through Email? So the truth is, it's not a new shaila. This is a shaila that's been around for a long time. It doesn't always talk about email, but there is extensive literature about can you ask forgiveness through letters? Or alternatively, if not through letters, can you ask forgiveness through a third party? Can you send a messenger to ask forgiveness on your behalf? So there's an extensive literature about this, and the general sense that you get is that that's not really considered to be ideal. That's something, it's better than nothing, but there is something about the face-to-face confrontation that ideally the purpose of this asking is that you're supposed to actually come and confront the individual and come submissively, and hopefully the individual will then grant forgiveness. If you're going to do it in a way that circumvents that type of interaction, so then that's not necessarily the full goal of what we're talking about. It's far better than nothing. Don't get me wrong. It's definitely much better than nothing, and that's what the Peleoites and others point out, that if the person is too embarrassed or otherwise physically unable to actually come in person, so then for sure it's much better to do it through a letter or to do it through somebody else. But if the choice is between coming in person or doing it through a letter, then the poskim seem to have a strong preference for actually dealing with this face to face. Sometimes you do both. Sometimes the letter is step one, and then after the letter opens up the door, then you can move to face to face. That's another thing. But the idea that there shouldn't be any actual contact, so we don't find that the poskim were so excited about this, apparently assuming that there should be some clear submissiveness and some clear interaction that has that connotation. You find that also in some interesting practices that are described in the Sfarim. The Maharshal talks about a certain ritual of tshuva, of repentance that was done, where people would get up in front of the congregation and they say, I have sinned in front of God, and I've sinned against God, and I've sinned against man. So some of the later Sfarim point out that the order is out of order, because if the Mishnah says you have to get forgiveness from your fellow first, he should really say it the other way around. So some suggest that the whole point of asking for forgiveness from your fellow man is to show you're willing to submit to this process, to show that you're humbling yourself. So therefore, once you're already making this announcement in public in this way, so then that's already effective. You can already say, I've sinned against God first. That's already an accomplishment, which is an interesting idea. A very similar idea, you find that the Vilna Gaon quotes from the Medrash Tanchuma, that if you have a situation where somebody asks for mechila and he's not successful, so in addition or in parallel to what we mentioned before about asking three times and doing your best, so there is also a suggestion in the Medrash that a person should gather together a minyan, and he should say that I have sinned against this man, I want you to know I'm publicly declaring my desire for forgiveness from him. So what does that accomplish? So apparently, again, it's not necessarily going to get the guy to forgive you anymore, but it seems that it also accomplishes going through a certain submissiveness, and therefore that's effective. So if that's the case, there's actually a discussion in some of the later svarim about what's the purpose of the minyan. Is this a minyan like you have a minyan in shul? Or maybe this is a minyan for the purposes of publicity. So it has different roles. It could be men and women together, perhaps. There's also a suggestion that maybe it is more like a minyan in shul, that maybe the idea is you want to invite the Shechina in, you want to invite the Divine Presence there so that you can have him be a part of the process. There's a whole analysis of what this minyan is meant to accomplish. So it seems to be revolving around this idea that you are trying to go through a process when you make the statement, and what exactly is the minyan contributing to that process. This could also perhaps... Yes, sir?
I always found it very subjective as to what it means you offended someone.
Oh, it's very subjective, yeah. We'll try to get into that a little bit more in detail. It's definitely going to be subjective. Presumably, where it's connected to some type of actual transgression that offends someone, but there's clearly a subjective element, so that gets tricky. We'll try to see if we can talk about that a little bit.
You say that the host can discourage asking mechila through a third party. Mm-hmm. Is that just in terms of an exception to the usual principles of shlichus?
Yeah, shlichus in general, it's a question of what that accomplishes. Normally, if there's something I need to bring about, so there's some type of result that needs to be brought into the world. So if I, then that's the categories where you have the ability to use somebody else to bring that about. But if there's something you need to do personally, if you need to put on tefillin, so you can't have a shliach put on tefillin for you, it's got to be on your head. You need to take an esrog, so you can't have somebody else do that for you. So too, if we're suggesting that the purpose is you need to go through a process of confrontation and submissiveness, so then you can't do that through somebody else. But you're right in illustrating that if it was just about bringing about the result of getting a release from claim, so then it shouldn't be a problem. But apparently, the poskim being more hesitant to endorse shlichus are assuming that it's about more than that. Right, exactly. It would come out to be a personal obligation, kind of a chovas aguf. So that's an interesting idea as well. There is a suggestion in the Ramah, which we could perhaps understand based on this before we say it. We should emphasize, don't try this at home, because it's a difficult policy to endorse, but just in terms of conceptually, what is the Ramah getting at? So the Ramah writes that one should not be reluctant, hesitant, to issue mechila when it's appropriate. That's something we'll talk about in a little more detail in a few minutes. But the Ramah writes, as a possible exception, he says you are allowed to delay forgiving somebody if it is letovaso, if it's for his own good, then you can do it. So what does that mean, it's his own good? How are you going to benefit somebody by delaying for forgiveness? So presumably what he means is that if there is this idea that the process is supposed to be significant, so if you're too quick, you don't let him go through the process, he's going to be missing out on the actual redemptive experience here. So that could be true. I would wonder, and later Sfarim as well, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu had a discussion about this, it's probably not our job to decide how much kapara somebody else needs. Presumably when we're ready to forgive, we should forgive right away. I wouldn't recommend anybody intentionally delaying it, saying, you know, I'm ready, but I think you could use a little bit more sweating. I wouldn't recommend anyone doing that. But presumably what the Rama means, that the theory of how it could ever be for his own good would be in that sense of the word. Again, practically, whether anyone should do that, I would highly say don't try that at home. But in any event, so this is a whole approach that exists, apparently backed up by all of these different proofs, that there is a value to the process, not just in order to obtain a waiver, but also to go through what needs to be gone through in order to obtain this personal growth, to really change and to really do tshuva. But there is another more positive orientation that you find that also emphasizes the process in a different sense. And it could be that the reason we need to go through actually asking and actually encountering the individual rather than just getting the waiver, it's not just because we want to embarrass ourselves. Maybe there's some value in that as well. But maybe it's about something more positive. that it has to do with the relationship. There is really a duality here. There's two different aspects to what it is we want to accomplish when you ask for forgiveness. Now, if you, let's say you broke somebody's leg, so you can ask the person for forgiveness, but even if they give it to you, so the leg is still going to be broken. Now, there may not be much you can do about that, but if you hurt their feelings, so hopefully there's something you can do. Hopefully there is something that you can smooth over if you go through the process properly. So perhaps what is being addressed here is that not only do you want to get a release of claims, but you also need to try to rectify the relationship. You need to try to bring things back in line, and that's also what we are insisting upon here. And that could also be reflected in this idea we mentioned before about asking three times. So the three times, again, to emphasize, it's not what they do in elementary school, Yemochemi, 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 but it's supposed to be three different occasions, but also three different styles. So first you say, listen, I'm really sorry, will you please forgive me? And the person says no. Then you come back and you bring them flowers, and you say, listen, I really hope you'll forgive me. And then they say no. And then you come back a third time and you explain what you were thinking, and now you realize this and such and such. Now will you please forgive me? And you're playing music for them. Whatever it is, each time you're going to do something different. You're going to have a different approach so that hopefully one of them will work. So apparently the issue is that you haven't really found the right avenue yet in order to fix things. So you keep working and trying to do what you can, at least within this framework of three times. And it could be that this is an issue that is particularly relevant to Yom HaKippurim. It says in the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar that the argument is made in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says you should have compassion on the Jews, you should forgive them, you should give them a successful Yom Kippur. Look how angelic they are. Look how much they like the Malachim. So how are they like the angels? So one of the examples is, he says, just like the angels, so they're not fighting amongst themselves, they're not in tension with each other. So too the Jews, believe it or not, they're not in tension with each other, they're not fighting with each other. So that seems a little bit like an ideal, but okay, so that's what is being suggested here, that maybe a part of the Yom Kippur process is that we need to have this state of equilibrium before it can be successful, which would explain why there is this connection specifically to Yom Kippur. Not only do we need a waiver of claims as soon as we can, but we also need to bring things back into line. The Medrash says in Parshas Tzav that Gadol HaShalom, that Shalom is such a powerful tool that Bezman Shehem B'Chabur Achas, that when the Jews are able to make one unit, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to forgive them even if they were involved in idolatry, even if they were involved in tremendous transgressions between man and God. God will still forgive if he sees that people are b'shalom with each other. So that's a tremendous thing. That's a tremendous statement. So that's perhaps the relevance to Yom Kippur. Not only do you need to have the charges dropped by the victim, but also HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm not interested in forgiving unless I'm so impressed by the way the Jews are able to bring about this state of shalom. So that could reflect, again, a few other ideas that you find in this process of asking for mechila. Rashi has a tshuva where he writes that you don't necessarily need the person to actually say he forgives. If the person comes up and hugs you and kisses you, so that's an expression of mechila. So we could probably figure that out on our own, but the idea seems to be that the focus is not just on my, okay, officially signing the papers and dropping the charges. The idea is that we need to rectify the relationships, and that seems to be what's being accomplished through this process, ideally. The Chassam Sofer said in one of his drashas, maybe it was a Shabbos Shuvah drash, I think he told his Mispalim, that in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when we had the Karbanos, there was not as much of a need for asking mechila. It's because the Beis HaMikdash itself was a centralizing influence that brought everyone together. So that accomplished a lot towards the goal of Yom Kippur. Now, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, when we're not brought together by other things, so there's a greater need for asking mechila than there once was, which is, again, a fascinating idea, and seems to reflect this notion as well, that this is a major theme in asking for mechila, bringing about this type of integration of the people of the community. And you find as well that here we're in Philadelphia. So I'll quote from the writings of one of the great Rabbanim of Philadelphia, Rav Baruch Lazarovsky, in a Sefer Tam Baruch, has a discussion about this as well, where he notes that there are different phrases that you find in the Talmud, that the Talmud talks about in the context of Maseches Bava Kamma, when it talks about if you've wounded somebody, so you have to pay damages, you have to do various reparations, and you have to request forgiveness. You have to ask for forgiveness. While the Mishnah in Yuma that we've been talking about, the one that's in connection with Yom Kippur, has a language of Ad Sheyirotze Es Chaveiro, you have to appease your friend. So he points out there's two different considerations here, that on the one hand you need the waiver of claims, you have to ask for something, and you need to actually appease the person, you need to go through a process which is going to make this individual more benachas, more at rest with you, happier, and without the tension that had been there beforehand. It's interesting also, it's noted that different approaches you could take to this question, but the Rambam says that if you commit theft, so if you steal something from somebody, so you have an obligation to fix things. So how do you fix things? It says you have to return the object that you stole, and you have to ask for forgiveness. While when it comes to the obligation, let's say if you damage somebody's property, so then again there's an obligation to fix things. So there he writes, you have to pay for the damaged property. But he doesn't say anything about asking for forgiveness. There's a whole discussion, why is that? How come if you have to pay for the property, or you have to return the property, when it comes to damages you don't have to ask for forgiveness? Apparently you give it back and it's done. And when it comes to stealing something, so then you have to ask for forgiveness. So the Lech HaMishnah, on the side of the page of the Rambam, the Lech HaMishnah suggests that if you're stealing something, so then you get benefit from it. So it's more likely to be an intentional type of offense. So even though he loses out the same way either way, if he gets his property stolen, or if he gets his property broken, he loses the same either way, and you need to make restitution. But if you're doing an intentional offense for your own benefits, that's much more offensive. So then there's greater rift that's created between you and this individual. So then there's a need to ask for mechila. So you're not asking for mechila just for his monetary temporary loss, because that is the same in both cases before you fix it, but you're asking for mechila specifically for the fact that there was this tension, the fact that there was this rift caused, which is a little bit relevant to the question you asked before. So we talk about offending somebody, so it's really offending in the connection with an avera. That if there is an avera, so sometimes you can do an avera, is technically an avera, but the person's not upset at all. The person, there's no tension that's created. So then you can rectify the problem without necessarily going through such an emphatic process on mechila. But when there is an avera that's also offensive, so then it becomes a more complicated story. When a person's offended without an avera, so then we want to rectify that also. But it also sometimes becomes difficult, becomes very subjective, so it's hard to pin down sometimes. Hi.
What if there's no error, and actually the insult with pain is the result of giving mussar to this person?
That could be an avera too.
You really felt in your heart that you were doing this person a favor, but nonetheless they took it in a way that they're angry with.
So, there's some subjectivity there also. You know, that could theoretically be an avera too. So what the Talmud says in Maseches Erchin that hochech tochech es hamisech, a person should give rebuke when somebody's doing the wrong thing. A person should give mussar to somebody. But then the Talmud goes on to say yachal afilu yishtan epanav, that maybe you could do it in such a way that the person's face will change color, that maybe that's appropriate also, even if it's going to humiliate them. So the Talmud goes on to say, no, look at the end of the pasuk. The end of the pasuk is lo sisa alav chet, you shouldn't incur an avera because of this process. You should do it in a way that doesn't offend the other person. Now, that's not always possible, and it's not always easy to judge. So the point being that theoretically that could be an avera as well, even if your motivation was to give mussar, but at the same time also it could be a legitimate mistake, or it could be that the need was so overriding that you were right even if you did offend him. So there's all three possibilities here, and that's where there's still going to be a subjectivity, and we'll still try to smooth things over as much as possible within the different subjective parameters that are going to be applicable to the situation. If a person is really doing something wrong and it's a threat to others and you can't stop them any other way, then you have to do that. So you can't always apologize, and they're not even going to necessarily forgive you. So then you have to do what you had to do. You had an overriding need. But if it's if you really did miscalculate, so then that could be an unintentional aver. If it really wasn't necessary to pour on so thick or so publicly, so then that technically could be an aver that was unintentional, and unintentional averus also need apologizing, or it could be somewhere in the middle. Again, there is all this subjective element to it, which is part of what we try to understand through looking at the different elements. And part of the subjectivity, so this could also be relevant. We mentioned before, delaying forgiveness for the good of the offender. We mentioned we're not recommending trying that at home. But there can be a role for delay, even on the part of the one asking, that maybe there is such an issue that a person doesn't necessarily have a good reason to ask for forgiveness immediately. Sometimes if you're going to ask for forgiveness immediately afterwards, so it's not going to be effective. It's not going to really contribute to this healing process. You need to give the person some time to calm down. And it may not be that you can ask immediately. And perhaps that's why we find, at some point out, you find the Yom Kippur idea, in addition to this being particularly relevant to bringing about the atonement on Yom Kippur, that maybe sometimes there is a value to letting you wait a little bit and then coming back before Yom Kippur. The Talmud has an expression, al yargiz adam b'shas kaiso, a person shouldn't try to take on somebody when they are inflamed and when they are angered. It's not going to be productive. So sometimes you do have to wait for some type of a cooling down process, and then you can come back and ask when it's going to be more effective. So that's also a part of the process, and it's also a calculation that has to be done carefully. And all of this is relevant to a very major historical dispute. It was a major debate between two of the great leading lights of Torah and Musar and Halacha. And, we're all familiar with the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim, written on the laws of Lashon Hara by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, one of the great classics of the past 200 years. So he was a younger contemporary of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who was known for starting the Musar movement, he was the one who really popularized the study of focusing on one's personality traits, on one's characteristics, on one's interaction with others. So one would think that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter would be the biggest fan of this book, Chafetz Chaim. And the truth is, he was. There are other indications that that was the case. However, it was somewhat of a surprising decision. The Chafetz Chaim asked him for a haskama. He asked him for an endorsement. And we know that's the practice when it comes to Sfarim. They write letters in the front of the Sfarim. People can say, yes, I know this person's father-in-law, or I looked at the cover of the book, or something like that, and it seems like a good book. Sometimes they go into it a little bit more. So this idea of asking for haskamas, this is an old practice. So the Chafetz Chaim asked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter for such an endorsement. And Rabbi Yisrael, surprisingly, he refused to write this endorsement. So why did he refuse to write it if he was such a fan of the book, which he was? So why did he refuse to endorse it? So he said that there's one ruling in there that I disagree with, and I'm not willing to put my name on it. People will think that I endorse everything in the book, that I'm signing off on all the rulings. I'm not willing to put my name on the sefer and give that impression. So the students asked him, you know, Rabbi, why don't you just write the haskama anyway? And you'll put a footnote on the bottom that says, by the way, on page 329, there's a ruling I think is wrong, which people do, by the way. There's a lot of critiques sometimes in haskama, so why don't you do that? Write a little footnote and say, on page 329, I think this ruling is wrong. So Rabbi Yisrael responded, he said, nobody reads the Haskamas anyway. So they're not going to actually read the letter. They're going to see my letterhead at the top. They're going to think I sign off on everything. And the truth is, I don't. So what was this controversial psak? What was this ruling that Rabbi Yisrael was so afraid, even though he thought it was a worthwhile book, he didn't want to for a second give anyone the impression that he agreed with this sentence? What was the controversial ruling? So to describe it in extreme terms, and we'll see if this is correct or not, and call this the case of Joe. You have Joe, he's a very happy man. Joe is sitting in his big easy chair, he's got a big flat screen TV, he's got a big bag of pretzels in one hand, a big bottle of soda in the other hand. He's an extremely happy person. So then Joe gets a call and he sees on caller ID that it's his best friend in the whole world, Bob. He's even happier. He's got everything he wants, and now Bob's calling. So he answers the phone. Bob says, "Listen, Joe, I have to speak to you. I've been taking a beginner's Judaism class, and I'm learning some things. So I learned two interesting laws. Apparently, you're not supposed to say bad things about people, lashon hara, something like that. Who knew? Okay, so I'm not supposed to do that. And I also learned that when Yom Kippur approaches, you're supposed to ask forgiveness for anything that you've done to anyone. So, about that, it seems that these past 20 years, when we've been hanging out, we've been best buddies, so I've been telling people constantly that I don't really like you, and I find you annoying, and your jokes aren't funny, and I think you're somewhat of a nebbish. The reason I hang out with you is because you usually pay for lunch. But other than that, I don't really think very much of you. So I've been telling this to people constantly over the past 20 years, and we laugh at you behind your back often, but I'm very sorry. And I hope that you will forgive me." So Joe is probably going to forgive because Joe's a nice guy. But I can guarantee that when Joe hangs up the phone, he's much less happy than he was when he answered the phone. So did Bob do the right thing by making this phone call?
No.
Wouldn't think so, right? So most people wouldn't think so. So that's the thing. So it sounds like from the Sefer Chafetz Chaim, and he was basing this on a psak of Rabbeinu Yonah, the Rishon, that it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim that that's what you have to do. You have an obligation to ask for forgiveness for interpersonal offenses. This is an interpersonal offense. Therefore, you have to ask for mechila. We'll discuss in a second, did he really mean it in as blatant a description as we just gave? There's some debate about that. But that's what it sounds like. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, "God forbid, how could you do such a thing?" There is another prohibition in the Torah, we alluded to it a few moments ago, called Onas Dvarim. You're not allowed to hurt somebody's feelings. So here you already have been sinning against this guy for 20 years, and so now you're going to sin again by devastating him, by telling him something that's going to make him miserable. A minute ago he was blissfully ignorant, and now he's going to be devastated, so you're allowed to do that just so you can clear your chest. Can't be, says Rabbi Yisrael, can't agree with such a ruling. I remember, I think I read as a child in the Art Scroll biography of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that it says that Rav Aaron Cutler, 100 years later, that Rav Aaron Cutler emphasized that the halacha was like Rabbi Yisrael, as did many of the later Svarim. So they asked him, but the Chafetz Chaim was based on Rabbeinu Yonah, was based on a Rishon. So essentially to argue with the Chafetz Chaim is really arguing on a Rishon. So that Rav Aaron Cutler had said, this is why it was in the biography, that Rav Aaron Cutler had responded that the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter Tanahu Palag, it's an expression you find in the Gemara that somebody is essentially a throwback to the previous generations. He's saying that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was so great, he was on such a level, he could argue with Rabbeinu Yonah. That was legitimate. But many did assume, and many probably should assume that that's the case, that Rabbi Yisrael was probably the right position here. So what exactly is going on? So did the Chafetz Chaim really mean that you should say this in the example that we discussed? So many of the later Sfarim find that very hard to believe, so they have different suggestions of what exactly was going on. Maybe it doesn't really mean that the guy would really have been blissfully ignorant forever, and now you're destroying his world by telling him. Maybe it means he already knew something was said, he didn't know who was saying it, or he was going to find out the next day anyway, so better you should tell him before he finds out from somebody else. They suggest different permutations. Many find it very hard to believe that the Chafetz Chaim would have endorsed a situation as extreme as we described. The person really wouldn't have known anything at all, and now you're devastating him by telling him about it. So if that's the case, okay, so then maybe there's general agreement that one shouldn't really ask into those circumstances. So what do you do? That's a good question. So then what do you do if you're not allowed to ask for mechila?
So perhaps the question is, can you ask mechila in a general way without being specific?
Very good suggestion. So we'll come to that in a second. So there are a number of suggestions of what you should do. And the best suggestion that you find in this forum is that this is a case of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That this is a good avera to avoid, because since it's so hard to fix, so if you're going to pick one to avoid, you should pick this one, although we don't do so well with that. And that's what the Talmud says, right? The Kulan, Bavak, Lashon Hara, all of us are guilty of this. But theoretically, this would be a good one not to be guilty of, because it's very hard to fix. In addition to being hard to fix by itself, you know, that's what the famous mashal about somebody who was told to cut open a pillow and walk around the city letting letting the feathers scatter all over the place. And then he was told, if you want to see what it's like to try to fix Lashon Hara, try to pick up all the feathers. It's not possible to undo. So that's when the guy knows about it. It's already impossible to try to fix the effects. But even if he doesn't know about it, so then bringing it up to him is going to be a problem. So what should you do? So it's a good avera to avoid. That's the best advice. Let's say, theoretically, actually, maybe once or twice did say something that you shouldn't have said. So then the suggestion is made along the lines of what you said. It's an important point to point out as well. That, again, not to pick on the elementary school students too much, and to ask a general mechila from them, but this is another idea that we learn in elementary school that's not really perfect. The whole idea, Erev Yom Kippur, so all the kids are running around saying, Yimochem, 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 Yimochem. So that's helpful as far as practicing. But as far as the actual mitzvah of Mechila, so that's not really what it's about. It says the commentaries on the side of the Shulchan Aruch explain that the way you're supposed to do it is you're supposed to go up to the person and say, listen, 2 weeks ago I punched you in the nose and I now realize that that was probably bad and I shouldn't have punched you in the nose and I'm really sorry and I hope you'll forgive me. You're supposed to be specific and you're supposed to go into detail. So that's really the way to do it. And this generalized kind of autopilot, are you mocheme, is not really the ideal. However, some suggest that maybe along the lines of what you're saying, that maybe it's helpful in this case, that if you have something that you're not able to actually spell out, that you're not able to really make clear what the issue was because it's going to do more damage. So then, Erev Yom Kippur, you come and ask for Mechila, you say, listen, if there's anything, I hope we're good, because it's not going to be taken as anything beyond that, because that's what everyone does on Erev Yom Kippur. Again, not ideal, but perhaps better than the alternative. Can take it, maybe you have to do it on Erev Yom Kippur. If you do this the day after Purim, so somebody's going to realize that you probably got a little drunk and said something about them, because why are you calling up the day after Purim? Oh, by the way, I just decided to ask you for Mechila. So that's not going to work. But if you ask on Erev Yom Kippur, so then the social reality is such that everybody's going around asking, so then that should hopefully be taken in the right spirit. Others suggest that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, in the Sefer that was published on the Rambam, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik goes through this whole machlokas in detail. And he suggests that, he says you can't ask Mechila. He thinks Rabbi Saul is for sure correct about this. He says you can't ask Mechila. What are you supposed to do? He says what you should do is you should try to counteract the effect. You should try to say positive things. You should try to do what you can to undo the effect of the negative information. Now, like we saw before with the pillow, it's not so easy to do that. It's not something that simple, but whatever you can do to try to reverse the impact, that's what's recommended. And asking for Mechila in such a circumstance is not recommended. So apparently this is an example of where we see different points of focus when it comes to asking for Mechila. That if it's about a waiver of claims, so that's one thing. But if it's about rectifying relationships, so then we can certainly understand what Yisrael is saying. It doesn't make sense to destroy a relationship so that you can then ask for Mechila. And this comes up in a few other cases. Lashon Hara is the most blatant example where you hurt someone, they don't know about it. You can find some other examples also. One is, for example, there's an avera called Choshed B'Ksherim. You suspect somebody, it turns out they're innocent. So it's not going to be so helpful if you call up somebody and say, you know, I really thought you were a terrible guy until yesterday. Then I realized, turns out I was wrong. So they're not going to really be so happy about that. So that's also something that's probably not recommended, even though you do find that in the Talmud. The Talmud does say that if you suspect somebody unjustly, you're supposed to ask them for forgiveness, but presumably that means that it was a public suspicion, that they know that you suspected them, you did something to accuse them, so then you have to ask for forgiveness. But if it's talking about, if we translate Choshed B'Ksherim, you thought badly about somebody and they don't know about it, then you're going to tell them what you were thinking, so that's really probably not the most advisable path. So we also find, we'll just finish up in a few minutes, just to mention this one contemporary discussion that addresses along the lines of some of the points we've been mentioning. There's a contemporary sefer called L'Reacha Kamocha. There's a lot of nice things on interpersonal interactions. So he notes that there is an interesting difference between two of the Rishonim, Rashi and the Meiri, in the way they comment on the Gemara in Bava Kamma. That the Gemara in Bava Kamma talks about the whole idea of asking for forgiveness. And in that context, it talks about why you ask for forgiveness. And Rashi says, because the individual worries about what he endured, And the Meiri says the individual worried. He went through something, past tense. And he suggests here that we find really two different models. That we find on the one hand the model of waiver of claim, something that happened in the past, you owe me because of what happened last week, and the model of reconciliation, that since we have this strife between us, something has to be done to stop me from worrying, so to speak, to address today's reality. And this really reflects two different approaches, two different things to what we are trying to accomplish. And he goes through a number of little questions that could come up in terms of these issues, in terms of which definition is it. Are we basically using a monetary model? Are we saying that you owe me money, I'm letting you go? Or are we talking about an emotional reality which might be a little bit more complicated? Rasul Salanter once gave an example. He said he gave advice to people. You want to make sure you have no issues with people. So people who did things to you, says the moment somebody offends you, you should be mochel right away. Because then you can't be upset about it later, because when it comes to a monetary debt, somebody owes you money, so you mochel, you say, forget about it. You can't come back a week later when you realize you need the money and say, I know I was mochel last week, but now I need it. Because once you're mochel, you cut off the claim, so it's done. So too here, you'll cut off the claim right away, you won't be able to be upset about it later. So if you have that type of control over your emotions, that it's a halachic man situation here where everything is automatically connected, you're mochel, all of a sudden you don't feel badly anymore, that's terrific. Is that the appropriate model? Is that exactly what's going on? So it seems like there is some combination of the two. It seems like on the one hand there is this issue of trying to release claims, and there's also another issue of creating a real environment of reconciliation. And that's a very serious consideration. So he writes in that Sefer L'Re'acha Kamocha that we should presumably be machmir for both. We should be stringent to try to bring about both realities. And this idea that's about effecting a reconciliation, so that's why we could also find that there is theoretically a burden even on the victim. That if the victim sees that if he makes the first step, like we saw from Rav in the Talmud, that if he takes the first move, that will allow for reconciliation to happen more effectively, to happen in a more productive way. So then he should do that. And if he's able to do that, if he's able to initiate the process, so then matovu manoim, that's highly recommended and that's highly laudable. And we also certainly find that if the person asks for forgiveness and he's genuine and he's sincere and he really deserves forgiveness, and the person doesn't want to give forgiveness, that's a serious issue. That's something that is seriously criticized in the Talmud. The question is just how much is it criticized. So the Mishnah seems to say that a person should not be achzari, should not be cruel and refuse to forgive. What does it mean cruel? The Meiri says he's cruel. He's not worried about what this person is going to go through in terms of punishment and in terms of emotional turmoil as well, and he's refusing to issue the forgiveness that has been earned. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, when it quotes this Mishnah, the text is a little different. And it sounds like from the Yerushalmi that it's not just cruel, but it's a transgression, it's an aveira. If somebody is asking for forgiveness legitimately and has gone through what he has to go through, and you're not forgiving him, that's a transgression not to forgive. And that's why there's actually an interesting literature that some discuss, that there is a halacha if you take a shvuah, not to, if you do a mitzvah. Somebody says he's takes a shvuah, he's going to eat treif. Or he takes a shvuah, he's not going to wear tefillin. So this shvuah is considered to be no good. The shvuah never gets off the ground. You don't have to worry that you're obligated to keep to this oath. The oath doesn't have any effect. So some of the svarim, Mr. Rishon already discussed, now what if somebody, as is sometimes the case, somebody takes the shvuah, I'm never going to forgive that guy. That guy got me so upset, I'm telling you, never going to forgive him. So is that an effective shvuah, that he has to go to a bezdin and have it undone? Or do we say, no, he doesn't have to go to a bezdin and have it undone, because the whole thing never gets off the ground. You can't take a shvuah against the Torah. So too, you can't take a shvuah saying you're never going to forgive anyone. Or a similarly common situation was discussed in the Tshuvas HaRash. Now, let's say a parent says to a child, you have Mr. Hatfield says about Mr. McCoy, he says, I'm telling you, never forget, you can never talk to that guy, you can never have anything to do with that family, we are at war with them, we're feuding, you can never have anything to do with that family. So the Rush assumes that you have here a situation where the parent is telling the child to violate the Torah. This is a transgression, and there is a rule that even though one is obligated to listen to his parents, if the parents tell you to do something that violates the Torah, so then they're not permitted to tell you to do this, then you're not obligated or allowed to listen. So the Rush assumes this is in that category, telling somebody not to forget forgive is going to be included within such a setting that's considered to be a violation of the Torah. So this is a very significant and very important idea, and it's very much connected to a notion that we find in Chazal throughout, that all this time we've been saying that if a person wants to get forgiven on Yom Kippur, so he has to ask for forgiveness from others, from the people who he has hurt, and that's crucial to the process. He's not going to get forgiven unless he obtains mechila, or at least goes through the process. But it's also equally the case that if a person wants to get forgiven, he has to be ready to forgive others. If he's not ready to forgive anyone else, so then it's going to have a, he's going to have a very difficult time getting forgiven. And the Talmud has an expression in Maseches Rosh Hashanah and elsewhere. The Talmud says that kol ha-maver al midosav mochlin lo al kol avonosav, whoever is ready to forgive, HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgives him for everything. The expression maver al midosav means you're willing to pass up your measurements. What does it mean, your measurements? So Rashi in his commentary to Rosh Hashanah says it means that a person's keeping score, a person's keeping track. This guy hurt me 6 points, this guy hit me 17 points, and I have to make sure to extract 6 points from this guy and 17 points from that guy. So whoever's willing to throw out that ledger, whoever is willing to forget about these measurements, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm also ready to forgive, I'm also mochel. And it's a very resonant idea, the idea that if we live in a system, we have a mentality that we think forgiveness of others is possible, is logical, is normal, so then midah keneged midah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can relate to us that way. Midah keneged midah doesn't only mean that it's proportionate, it means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu acts with us, acts to us in a way that we can understand, a way that we can relate to. So if in our life we don't have any kind of mercy, we don't have any kind of forgiveness, so then it's going to seem unjust. Why should God forgive us for anything? But if we relate to the idea of forgiveness, that's a part of how we interact with others. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I can forgive you as well. Just imagine how incongruous it is. We're davening on Yom Kippur, we're saying, God, please forgive me for all my sins. So God's going to respond, but you didn't forgive that guy. So we'll say, yeah, you know what he did? He did something really bad. And we're supposed to forgive him? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to say, you know what, I'm a little offended too. So that's it's not going to be effective if we don't have the ability to forgive others. So it's understandable. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to say, this Yom Kippur is not effective for you either. So both of these elements, asking for forgiveness and being ready to grant for forgiveness, both of these are crucial elements of what we are mispalel for Yom Kippur and what we need to do to hopefully have a successful season of tshuva and of bracha. So we'll just quickly review what we spoke about. So we spoke about the fact that there is this obligation in the Mishnah to ask for forgiveness. The Mishnah says that Yom Kippur is not mechaper unless you do that. And we saw different understandings of what that means. Either that if you have a transgression that's both interpersonal and between man and God, God's not going to forgive his part. All that all transgressions have that duality because they're against God's law, or that God is saying, as a Gra understood, he's not going to forgive anything unless you get atonement for that which you have done for others. A very, very, very surprising idea. So we started to discuss why that was. So we questioned, is it about just getting a release of claims, getting to drop the charges? If that were true, if you knew the person was willing to publicly forgive, if you had some reason to believe the guy had dropped the charges, you shouldn't have to ask. If you know if he says Tefillah Zakar, or he says Kriyash Malamita with his phrase, or some other way in which he announces it, you shouldn't have to forgive. But the post can generally assume that's not the case. We see the Gemara about Rav and the butcher seems to be not that way. So apparently you have to actually go through the process of asking. And we also noted the fact that it's connected to Yom Kippur, an interesting idea. It would seem to be really, you should ask for mechila right away no matter what. The connection to Yom Kippur doesn't seem to really be necessary. So then we discussed the question of, is there this emphasis on process specifically, even separate from getting what you want? And then maybe it's like the stirring with the tea, that maybe the idea is you need to go through the process, and the getting the mechila is really more indicative of going through the process properly rather than the actual goal. And we mentioned the possibility that maybe it's about going through a submissive process that call osa averu misbayish. If you're embarrassed, you get mechila for everything. And we discussed the Din of Shulchan Aruch, that if somebody asks three times and doesn't get forgiveness, he's done. We don't find that in any other area of life. If you ask three times and don't get what you want, you automatically get it. It must be that there is this emphasis on the process. We talked about the discussion in Poskim about having a third party ask for mechila, or having a letter instead of confronting directly, how that's considered to be less than ideal, although far better than nothing, but less than ideal because it is missing this type of confrontation. We talked about some of the rituals discussed in the earlier Svarim, the idea of getting standing up in front of the community and saying, I've sinned in front of God and in front of man, that readiness to make the declaration makes you ready to ask for forgiveness from God. The Vilna Gaon's discussion about from the Medrash Tanchuma that you get together a minyan if the person's not going to forgive you and say, I've sinned against this guy, that's also somewhat of an effective process. And the whole discussion about what the minyan is for, is it about publicity or is it about evoking the Shechina and how that affects things. And then we talked about the statement of the Ramah that we emphasize, don't try this at home, that if it's for the good of the person, you're allowed to delay mechila. Again, we understood theoretically what he meant, even though practically it's a dangerous policy. And then we looked at the different approach, that maybe it's not just about going through embarrassment, but it's about going through reconciliation, about making there be an actual change in emotions between the offender and the victim. And that could also be why we have this notion of three times, each time a different approach, a different attempt in order to bring that about. And I mentioned the Pirkei Derbalazer, which says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is told you should forgive the Jews because they're angelic, because they get along with each other. So apparently that's a part of the process of Yom Kippur as well. And then we talked about the Rashi's tshuva, that if a person comes and hugs and kisses you, that's an expression of mechila right away. And we talked about the drasha of the Chasam Sofer. We said that the karbonos used to bring us together, so there was less of a need for mechila. But now that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so we have a greater need for asking mechila. We talked about Rav Lazarevsky's observation. There's two different languages you find in the Talmud, asking for mechila and appeasing, apparently referring to these two different ideals. And then we talked also about the Rambam, who requires you to ask for mechila in addition to restitution, if you stole something, but not if you damaged something. And the Lach Mishnah explaining that it's more offensive if you stole something than if you damaged something, and that could be why there is such a difference. And then we mentioned that there could be a value to delaying, then, if it's going to be more effective, that Al Yargiz Adam B'Shais Kaso, you don't necessarily want to take on somebody when they're angry. Sometimes you have to wait a little while, maybe until Yom Kippur, in order for that to be effective. And there is also a discussion, the machlokas between the Shaul Salanter and the Chafetz Chaim, that the Shaul didn't want to give a haskama to the Chafetz Chaim because he seems to say that you should ask Mechila for speaking Lashon Hara about somebody, even if they don't know about it, even if that's going to devastate them. And the Shaul Salanter said that's terrible, that's no nos tevarim. He mentioned different approaches to understanding what the Chafetz Chaim really meant. He probably didn't mean it in a circumstance where the person really wouldn't have known anything. And we discussed alternative approaches, whether you should ideally avoid this aver to begin with, or rely on a more generalized mechila on Erev Yom Kippur, even though normally that's not ideal, but maybe that's what's recommended here, or Aaron Soloveitchik's approach that you should try to counteract what you did with positive information. All this reflecting the fact that mechila is not just about the claims, but it's also about smoothing over the relationship. And therefore, there is also a imperative on the victim as well to try to do what he can in order to make the relationship better. If that means taking the initiative, that's terrific. If he can't take the initiative, but the person actually has come and sincerely asked, so then he is supposed to grant mechila. We mentioned that the Mishnah says if he doesn't do that, he's considered to be cruel. And the Yerushalmi has a different edition, which sounds like it means he is sinning. And there was a discussion in Poskim, if somebody takes an oath not to forgive someone, that might be considered an oath in violation of the Torah, maybe, maybe not. But there is also the tshuva of the Rush. If a parent says to a child, don't forgive that guy, so it may not be within the parent's authority, because that might be a violation of the Torah. And we talked also about this discussion in the contemporary Svarim about how we look at the whole nature of forgiving. Is it a release of claims, or is it more emotional reality? I mentioned that suggestion that it correlates to a statement of Rashi and the Miri, two different ways of interpreting a Mishnah, and that has many different sub-ramifications, such as if you automatically give forgiveness, can you go back on it later? Many other questions that are asked along those lines, all leading one to the suggestion that we should really be machmir for both, that we should really try to both get a release of claims and try to smooth over things, and all of this reflecting the fact that this obligation to ask for mechila and its crucial role in bringing about a successful Yom Kippur is also true in the other direction. There's an equally crucial obligation to grant mechila, and that's also equally significant upon our having a successful Yom Kippur, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to be able to give us forgiveness if we don't relate to the whole idea, if that's not something that we practice in our lives. And that's what the Gemara says, that Kol Amavir Al Midosav Mochlo Mochlo Avonosav, if we have the ability to forgive, HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates that way as well and issues us forgiveness. It should be our bracha that that's what we should do, that we should be able to work in both directions, to obtain forgiveness, to give forgiveness, to feel forgiveness all around, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should relate to us in the same way, and we should have a year of peace, of shalom, and only of bracha. Amen. Thank you very much.
just going to have him zoom in, then we'll take questions. A reminder before revenge that the next Kolya Rishon is actually on Tzom Gedalia on October 2nd. So everything will be the same except no breakfast.
used the spoon of coffee to demonstrate places where the halos is separate from the And they don't go to Yom Kippurim, so that's the same idea. In other words, Rosh Hashanah is really when it happens, that's the Shugurim, but then the Yom Kippurim, the Shofar Yom Kippurim is what brings it out. You had a bunch of examples.
Sounds great. Sounds good. Thank you. Pleasure. Really good. Thanks.
Shalom Aleichem, John Pingleby.
Good to meet you.
Three. What? Ramam, everyone comes down three times. What's that? Why three times?
It seems to be that that's what a reasonable attempt would be. Three times. The person's not responding already.
Six times, seven times, three times.
I guess the Chazal figured out that this is a reasonable process.
This is forgiving people, and this is not forgiving people, and this is not forgiving
people. Back to the presentation. Question: and where if Reuven offends Shimon, Shimon unfortunately dies before Reuven can either hasn't forgiven him or doesn't have a chance to forgive him. Do I recall seeing somewhere that it was practiced to go to take a minion to the Kvur Hever of the offended party?
It seems to be in the same spirit.
Tell me, you also was it mentioned in the introduction that you're an expert on humor as well as let's say humor is very important. To me. And one of my hobbies is composing trifling more proverbs, various situations, observations, and things. One of them is
services rendered.
Right.
The other one is he's a herbie play by Ben Adam.
That's true, no question. Dangerous question. Steve Sinatova, he mentions that use of technology like the but I was wondering, can you ask me to see like Skype or video a little more computational?
Yes, right.
So a matter of degree, rise to the level of